Fearless.
House Committee on Revenue will return to order. You'll recall we met this morning, colleagues. And one of the things that we did was pass out House Bill 3465. I understand there is a motion on that bill, so we'll reopen the work session on House Bill 3465. Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3465, as amended, was sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves to reconsider House Bill 3465, or at least the vote that sent it to the floor. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? If not, the motion carries. And that puts the bill back in the authority of the committee, doesn't it? Right. Okay. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3465. And we'll open a work session on... you're in 3405, yes?
Yeah, well, we don't have that.
We don't have it yet, so we can do 2180.
Right. And we think we're picking up a...
So let's do that. Okay, we'll open the work session on House Bill 2180. Chris?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as you recall from this morning, House Bill 2180, we were going over a -A10, and within that they contained three policies. It eliminated the Red Team Betsy credit for gasoline-powered hybrids. It expanded the Betsy for electric vehicle manufacturing, and it contained a biomass credit provisions. And there were a number of questions on current law and with respect to electric vehicles and what are the requirements for getting a RETC or Betsy. And the Department of Energy is in the room to answer some of those questions.
Great. Let's ask them. Ah, there she is. Good. Come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Betty Merrill from the Oregon Department of Energy.
Thank you. You didn't have a presentation, did you? You were hoping to answer questions.
I was hoping to answer questions.
All right. Representative Gelser.
I can ask a question.
Please do.
Thank you. So, if I understand this bill correctly, it simply scales back the existing credit for alternative fuel.
Actually, I think you're referring to the -10.
Yes, the -10. So the -10 amendments, it scales back the tax credit for existing eligible alternative fuel vehicles. So I, for instance, am not a big supporter of tax credits for alternative fuel vehicles. Mm-hmm. Under the -10, instead of voting to expand those, what I'm really doing is supporting the effort to roll those back and not offer as many. Am I understanding this correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, you are correct. What this bill is doing is on for both the Betsy and the RETC. What it's doing is it's sunsetting the provision for hybrid vehicles on January 1st, 2010. However, the Betsy program does consider alternative vehicles as electric-powered vehicles under the existing statute.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, that satisfies the concern that I had previously raised with this bill.
Great. Were there other questions on the -10? And I understand we're going to have another amendment. Yes, Representative.
Just a scale question. We had a little bit of this earlier this morning, but how many cars are we talking about a year currently, and how many will, if you will, fall off? If you can break that down, sort of Oregon sales in a, I know you can't get exact, but just a rough estimation.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I didn't actually bring the car numbers in terms of numbers, and LRO has done a revenue impact, so I would defer to Chris.
Representative Brune, currently in the neighborhood of 3,000.
That was the number we heard this morning. So ostensibly going forward, 3,000 less cars will qualify for.
Yes, and there's and the baseline is something of a growth rate, so over time that would grow a little bit more, but in that neighborhood.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, right.
Highway transportation.
Yes.
Highway.
Thank you. I'm being reminded of the questions I had this morning about the bill. We're trying to understand the current law sets up categories for alternative energy devices, and I think these cars are considered to be category one, if I understand. I'm not sure what category one is, and I'm also interested in understanding what alternative fuel vehicles would be covered by this. The questions that have come up have involved things like non-highway speed vehicles that might be usable in town but not on the highway, vehicles that have fewer than four wheels, three wheels or two-wheel vehicles, and recreational vehicles that might be powered by batteries rather than by gasoline engines. What can you tell us about the way in which this current law categorizes these vehicles and whether or not they're covered under this section for a tax credit?
Mr. Chairman, member of the committees, there's two separate tax credit programs. There's the residential energy tax credit and the business energy tax credit. Each are handled a little differently. For alternative fuel vehicles, they fall under our alternative fuel facilities. For the residential energy tax credit, those are capped at $1,500. In the business energy tax credit program, those would be the calculation would be based on 35% of the incremental cost of the vehicle. The standards set up for those are done under rule by the Department of Energy.
So what does the rule currently say about these kinds of vehicles? Does it deal with the issues that I've raised at all?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the current way that the calculation was made for hybrid vehicles, as we know them today, the Prius, for example, is that we used standards developed by EPA and the feds to determine which vehicles would be eligible. When we calculate energy savings, we're calculating those energy savings based on vehicle miles reduced, so on your energy savings, and we've been calculating those on 15,000 miles per year average. So the theory would go that if you're looking at a vehicle that is comparable to a vehicle that would be driving on the highway for regular use, the average vehicle travels about 15,000 miles, and that's how you determine the energy savings. So a vehicle that wasn't equipped for highway travel, you would calculate savings at slightly different rate, wouldn't be 15,000 miles a year.
But it would still be considered. I'm thinking specifically about some of the cars that are being designed in Oregon that would not be intended to be used on the highway because they wouldn't be highway speed vehicles. And I'm wondering if we have regulations that cover those vehicles or whether they're excluded under the regulation from these credits. And of course, we're talking about electric vehicles, 100% electric, right, not hybrids.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, currently that's handled under rule, and the Oregon Department of Energy has an open rulemaking process where we consider what the criteria is for the vehicles that would be covered.
Okay, Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I was trying to find the answer to my own question, so I apologize if some of this was covered already. And it's been some time since I've taken this part of the bill on, so I think I knew the answer to this at one point. Is it true that it's this bill that allows the department, if it were passed, to have the authority to move the level of the credits in response to market conditions and acceptance and that sort of thing, just in rulemaking?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, that was the intent in one of the amended versions.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that's included in the A-10s.
Might I ask that of staff, Mr. Chair? Is that not affected in the A-10s or the A-11s, which we might discuss later on. Is that right?
Correct. It's not in the A-10s.
Okay. So it would stay in the bill?
The A-10s is a gut and stuff.
Oh, entirely. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess that
answers that. Okay. All right. So if a car manufacturer, I'm sort of wondering how these rules get established. now that I've learned that it's covered in rule. We apparently don't have a definition in statute except some kind of an energy savings or a renewable energy standard, or what is the standard that's in statute, if there is one, around the rulemaking process that you have for the definition of an alternative fuel vehicle that's worthy of the credit?
It's in here, though. I can't find it.
There's no definition.
Hmm?
No definition.
I didn't think so.
Yeah. Read it. I got my glasses on.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Ivo Turma with the governor's office. I believe if you look at page 1 of the 810s here in section 1-2A, if you read this, the credit shall be based upon the first year energy yield of the alternative energy device. So it is based on energy savings.
Okay, so that really isn't going to cover 100% electric vehicles, is it? Since I don't know how you would go about calculating energy savings unless you were to compare it. Would you compare it to a gasoline-powered vehicle? Is that what you would do?
I guess, yes.
All right. So if a manufacturer was planning to manufacture the kind of vehicle I was describing a moment ago, they could approach the department and ask the department to consider a rule that would determine whether or not the vehicle that they were working on would qualify for the credit? Is that how it would be done, or would it be done in some other way?
Mr. Chairman, the department, when we open up rulemaking on a new class or expansion of a new technology, we hold a rulemaking process. We look to other authorities, whether they be EPA or national auto standards, and look at vehicle efficiency, gasoline mileage, CO2, emission standards. Those kinds of things would all be considered in the rulemaking process to determine what an eligible product would be.
Okay. And if the national standard didn't refer to three-wheeled vehicles at all, then you wouldn't consider three-wheeled vehicles. National standards, as I understand them, essentially exclude non-highway vehicles and vehicles that have less than four wheels. Now, I'm not certain if that's true, but that's what I'm told.
Mr. Chair, if I may, this issue was addressed in what would have been the Dash 8s, where it was referred to as a roadway-ready vehicle that included two wheels and three wheels, and four wheels, I guess. But in the current version, that's not in this bill. This would probably address your concerns the most direct way.
Okay, the Dash 8s, are you suggesting the Dash 8s would be needed in order to do that?
The Dash 8s was also a gut and stuff, but the definition was in there, language-wise.
All right, great. Thank you. All right, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have our experts been given the Dash 11s?
I don't know that they have, and we ought to make sure that they do get them. I found a problem with the Dash 11s already, but that's it may be explainable. Could we see that they get the Dash 11s, and then perhaps we can have Chris explain what we've got, and I think Representative Reed may want to speak to them.
Mr. Chair, the Dash A11, the intent there, and I also just got it, so I haven't had a chance to go through it, would increase the credit from $1,500 to $2,500 for the plug-in vehicles. And I'm looking at page 7 now, and it seems to be some language there that does that. That piece is within the Betsy.
On page 2.
And page 2 would do that for the Retsy, it looks like.
It's a total of 5,000.
No, it'd be one or the other.
One or the other?
It is one or the other, isn't it? You can't get both, can you?
Correct. You get one or the other. The credit, if it's like an individual purchase, they would get a RETSI. If it's purchased for a business, you'd get a RETSI.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chris, could you tell us then how one would calculate the amount of the credit? It says will not exceed $2,500. Does that mean it could be less than that?
Maybe you have the answer to that.
Mr. Chairman.
Please.
Yes, up to would be the top limit. The way the credit is calculated is 35% of the incremental cost.
Mr. Chair?
Are you finished, Representative Bass?
No.
Let's let him continue, and then we'll get to you in a minute.
So maybe you could take us through an example of a hypothetical car purchase.
Okay. So if, and I'm making up numbers for ease here. Say you purchased an electric vehicle, and the incremental cost was $10,000. The cost over gasoline comparable vehicle was $10,000 more. The tax credit eligible amount will be calculated as $3,500 with a cap of $2,500. So the tax credit would be $2,500 in that case.
Yes, please. Yeah.
And is that the language that spells out what you just told us appear in the dash 11s?
It appears in other Betsy.
Mm-hmm. You actually did cover all this, didn't you, Representative Reed?
I just don't know that I get credit for it.
Sure, it looks like it.
Well, Mr. Chair, while they're searching for that answer, I did want to point out that on page 21, the other change that's in the A11s is moving the sunset for that portion closer to our to a date less distant in the future. So it would be a bigger bump than the A10s, but shorter duration.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Pence. If you look at page 6 of the dash 11, section 2 deals with the BETSI, the Business Energy Tax Credit. If you look at sub A here, it talks about, and it's hard to define because it talks about 10%, 10%, 5, 5, 5. So here's the 35% spelled out in how you take the credit over 5 years. And then it goes on page 7, the in bold, number D then talks about may not exceed $2,500. So this is how these definitions work together.
Thank you.
And that's for the business energy tax credit. Is there something comparable for the RETSI, the residential energy tax credit?
That works slightly different, doesn't it?
I see. It's actually probably in sub D on page 2, lines 24 through 27, which says that for an alternative fuel vehicle, the credit allowed under the section is 25% of the cost of the alternate fuel device, but the total shall may not exceed $750 if the credit is placed in if the device is placed in service on or after January 1, 1998. And then, of course, the new language says that notwithstanding, an alternate fuel vehicle is an electric vehicle designed for plug-in charging. The credit may not exceed $2,500. And I suspect that if the vehicle costs $10,000 or more, you would get the $2,500 credit if it otherwise complied with the rules. Is that? I think that's the way I would read that. Well, it appears to me, colleagues, given the silences, that we need to study these in some detail, and perhaps we might be ready to work this tomorrow, but I'd like to hear from Representative Reed about anything else he'd like to say about the Dash 11s.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a good discussion and a good description that's already happened on the A11s. My intent is to recognize the challenging economic times we're in and to not change the total effect, but to try and front-load the boost that we might give to the consumer adoption of these new technologies and thereby help those manufacturers who might be considering Oregon as a location to view this as a market where they would like to be. I think that's a fairly simple motivation on my part.
Okay. Representative Gelser, we never got to you.
Yes.
I think you have some comment or question.
I do, and I appreciate what my friend is trying to do. However, I cannot support the Dash 11s because it is an expansion of that electric car tax credit. It increases what is currently given for an electric car in a tax credit. I was comfortable with the Dash 10s because it was a scaling back of tax credits for alternative fuel, for the consumer credits for alternative vehicles. I just think at this time our general fund dollars are better and more importantly spent on services for seniors and schools and higher education and other critical things. All of these are general fund dollars, and I'm happy to support the Dash 10s, but I just remain discomforted with providing a consumer tax credit for electric cars, and we don't have the infrastructure to support electric cars, and really only higher income individuals are going to be able to afford to go out and purchase a new car.
Thank you. Anything else now? I think what I'd like to do, I was initially thinking we might move the bill if we were in agreement on the Dash 10s, but I think given the silences that people are studying both of these amendments, and unless you think we're ready to do something today, I think I'd prefer that we held it over until tomorrow in the hopes that people would have a chance to study both of these amendments and determine what the other issues are. I, for example, am concerned about the change in the sunset date because it appears to me that it moves the sunset date for one particular class of vehicles from 2012 to 2014, and may interact with House Bill 2067, which was recently amended by the Senate and will be coming back to the House for concurrence. So I'm not sure. It's not clear to me whether this actually shortens the sunset date or extends it.
Mr. Chair, the intent certainly was to shorten it.
Was to shorten it, yeah. That's what I thought. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I have a question as long as we have our experts up here. And I'm sorry that we went over this, but I don't quite understand. Does the department currently allow for a tax credit for 2- and 3-wheeled vehicles?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, currently not. I don't believe anyone's come in for a tax credit for a 2-wheeled vehicle.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
And if the A-10s or the A-11s become law, will those vehicles qualify?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey, until we go through rulemaking, at this point, the bill does not say they will not qualify. Does not disqualify those products.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Please, yeah.
Were there any amendments so far that would have explicitly allowed for them to qualify?
It wasn't an amendment. It was in the Dash 8s that would have addressed that specific. It is certainly the intent from our office to include them.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And would it be correct to say then that the absence of that provision from the A8s in the A10s and the A11s does not indicate less of an interest in including those vehicles in the final rulemaking process? It just did not carry over in the iteration of the drafts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, we weren't involved in drafting the Dash 10, but I would assume there was no intent to leave them out. The intent in the Dash 8 was just to make it more specific.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
And just so I'm clear, it is not necessary to have that called out as it was in the A8s and the A10s and the 11s for you to achieve your objective. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, that's my understanding. Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Representative Bailey, go ahead.
I'm okay, Mr. Chair.
You're okay. Other questions? This is the time, I think, before we sleep on it, to talk about the difference between the A10s and the 11s and what the effects of of these amendments would be. We do need to move the bill in one form or the other because of the sections involving the certification of biomass credits, which I think are in the A11s as well as in the 10s, and closing off the credits on the current hybrids, which I think everyone agrees are well established and don't need the Oregon tax credit any longer. In one sense, I guess it would have been useful if we'd had a rule similar to the federal rule that only allowed an initial boost and then ended them after that, but we don't have such a rule. But if I understand this amendment correctly, that on the top of page 8 and again on maybe it's before that, on page 5, and also the top of page 5, that effectively cuts off the credit for, wait a minute, yes, it effectively cuts off the credit for the current crop of gasoline electric hybrid vehicles. That is the ones that don't do electric plug-in charging for both the Betsy and the Retsy. All right, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Chris indicated we didn't have a cost yet on
the 11th.
Right.
And yeah, so we'll have to hold that until tomorrow anyway. Then. Yeah. Thank you. That does deal with that. All right. Well, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2180 with the intention of reopening it tomorrow, if we can get another agenda for that, and if we have time, because there are other higher priorities for tomorrow. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3405. Do we have that amendment yet? Hasn't
we
come.
Might have just gotten it.
Well, we do have it. All right. Well, open a work session on House Bill 3405. Colleagues, we've just received another amendment, which Paul is about to pass out. What I was hoping we'd do this afternoon is to discuss it briefly and recognize we don't have the paperwork we need to actually move it to today, and then we'd come back tomorrow morning, hopefully with that paperwork, with the intention of opening and moving House Bill 2649 and House Bill 3405 tomorrow, along with 2180 and whatever else we have on the agenda. And this is the dash 9, is that right? As soon as he's finished passing them out, why don't you go ahead and explain what the new proposal is. Oh, Paul's going to do it. Okay, good.
Chair, members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. You are seeing the dash 9s, and we're seeing them for the first time also. We did make a minor change from the dash 6s that you had seen in some of the language around partnerships in Section 3 on page 3. And this was actually in the dash... Lose track, Chris. Dash
8.
I thought the dash 8.
The dash 8. Dash
yeah, 8. Dash 8, which you haven't seen, which you
we've never discussed.
The amendments of which we will not speak.
Yeah, you will never see. Yes.
Well, you don't have to.
Sorry,
talk about
you don't
it
get then to see it. So those were some language changes based on discussions with Department of Revenue to make it clear in terms of the entity tax on partnerships, that it was for those conducting business in the state and not a partnership involving an Oregon residence that was not operating in the state, that would be, for example, operate outside the state.
Now, this is Section 3?
Section 3, page 3, yes. Okay. Uh-huh. But the big change is in the C Corp minimum structure, and it just redesigns the structure a bit. And the rest of the components, there you have just our score sheet on the rest of the components is there that reflects the dash nines. The total numbers are the same on that. Bill does is it takes the lower level of sales and breaks it up into more categories, and you can see that if you look on that on the spreadsheet that shows it. Now, the previous structure had organ sales less than 500,000 would be 150, 500,000 to a million would be 500, and then the changes come in that $1 to $10 million category. They're broken up in much finer detail, and you can see that it ranges up from 1,000 to 1,500 to 2,000, 4,000 for those 3 to 5 million, or excuse me, 5 to 7 million, 7,500 for those 7 to 10 million, and then it goes to 15,000 for those 10 to 25 million. It does hit the $100,000 cap at 100 million, and the previous version was 250 million in sales, so it hits that sooner. The result of this change and the structure is the same amount of revenue, $93 million is our revenue estimate, but you have a lower share at the lower end of the Oregon sales. And this is based on input that that I think that the committee received and concerns about the impact on firms of that size. So those are the two main elements. I believe, was there one other?
There was the deletion on the Secretary of State.
Oh, that's right. The Secretary of State collection of their fees, there was a we've deleted a section at their request, and basically what we anticipate happening with the Secretary of State filing fees, the uniform conduct, commercial code documents, and notary documents, you have an estimate in your fiscal impact statement of those, and those would be retained by the Secretary of State, and they would have to have authority from the Ways and Means Committee to appropriate those toward their costs.
Representative Berger?
That was language that was excluded or added?
The language that was in the previous version just said that they were able to carry those forward, as I recall.
Yeah, on page 7, lines 16 through 21, you'll see in the dash 9 is deleted.
Okay.
And that was unnecessary language.
So in other words, they would have the revenue by the estimates would come in, but then they would need the authority to expend them.
Got it.
Okay, so the new language, the new language then is sub 4, starting on page 6 and carrying over into page 7. Have I got that right? That the Secretary of State then would deposit part of the fees into the operating account, and then the rest of it would go to the general fund, and that takes care of what was in the part that we're deleting.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, and this satisfies the Secretary of State does what he thinks or she thinks needs to be done.
Yes, it was at their request.
All right, great. Now's a good time for questions for Paul or Chris on the changes between this amendment and the dash 6, I think it is. We've dealt with most of those, but if there are any questions, now would be a good time. I do expect to hear from a couple of people, one or two people tomorrow, and then hopefully we'll have the paperwork that we need in order to move the bill. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And these are pretty simple questions. Also, just if a corporation, a C corporation, has made a net profit, then can you explain to me how the? Let's just go to the $100,000. That's an easy one. If they've made a net profit, is that $100,000 then just subsumed into the tax they would otherwise pay? It's not in addition to the income tax they would otherwise pay.
Right. It's an alternative. It's an alternative minimum. So you pay one or the other.
So if their income tax were $75,000, calculated in the normal manner, then they would, and they had a gross Oregon sales more than $100 million, they would simply pay the $100,000,
yes,
because that's higher than their income tax amount. On the other hand, if their income tax amount was $150,000, they would pay that instead.
Yes. It's an alternative minimum, so you would pay the...
whichever was more.
Yes, whichever was more.
Yeah, that answers it, Mr. Chair. Then, and thank you, Paul. And then the corporate filing fee structure, the $100 that will now be paid, that is, if I recall correctly, is that for... this says filing fee, but that's for any filing, so an annual report would then be $100.
Yes.
And that is a filing fee, and that is in addition to then an income tax.
Yes, that is not a part of the income tax system. That's through the Secretary of State filing and registry system. So that's separate, and that's collected by the Secretary of State when you get those documents.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
The all filing $50 fee, does that include then the UCC filing fees? Or the... I can't remember now.
No, it does not. There's a separate language in there regarding those fees.
Top of the page.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. So those go from the $10 to the $15.
Yes, correct.
We had testimony on when that was last changed. Do you recall what it was?
I don't recall, Mr. Chair, but the Secretary of State, it had been some time.
Yeah.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
That $15 amount, I can't remember. I think you did do a graph that showed us how that compared to Washington, Idaho, and California.
That's correct, Representative Benson. The Secretary of State gave you a chart of what the other states had in those categories at the hearing yesterday.
A lot of things have happened since yesterday.
While we're looking at that, I'll ask another question.
Please.
The corporate minimum structure now, and again, it maybe it's reflected in that same chart, but how does that minimum structure fit with the other states?
The minimum structure is...
Here's what he passed me out. Here it is.
I would say it's a hybrid system. We've had some states that have gone to a gross receipts base. For example, New Jersey did, Kentucky did for a time, that have had an alternative minimum based on gross receipts, that have had percentages that can generate revenue that would be comparable to this, and in some cases more. But those that just have a flat fee, California, for example, and the other states, these would tend to be higher. Those tend to be in the $500 to $1,000 range. Those that are just a flat minimum. So this is kind of a hybrid between those that have gone to something as a percentage of sales versus those that have a simple flat fee. So it falls in between those two systems.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
The question, of course, is I'm going to go to the $75 to $100 million classification of $50,000 minimum tax, regardless of net income. I'm just trying to determine if there's any other state that charges those kinds of numbers in the absence of net income.
Representative Benz, yes. The states that charge that much are those that have a gross receipts base, like a Washington B&O tax, the Ohio commercial activity tax, and I had mentioned earlier New Jersey had an alternative minimum that was based on gross receipts as a percentage. So we have seen those kind of percentages in those states, but those that have just a flat amount, no, these would exceed what we typically see in those other states. And I think those numbers are on the chart I'd given you on corporate income tax rates. It does have a listing for minimums on that. And you can see that most of them are in that $500 to $1,000 range. I think California is $900.
Well, there it is. You got it. Yep. You have it.
Yeah, they do. And that, Paul, then, do you think that this is a comparable amount, or did you say earlier it's a higher amount? I'm just trying to put this in some sort of context. So maybe you could help me and just say, are we now higher than Washington, even though Washington has a gross receipts tax?
No, I would say that these percentages are lower than Washington's B&O tax, which tend to be at the 0.14% range.
Which would make
commercial those are the lowest ranges. They tend to be around 0.5% in the Washington B&O tax. I can get you those rates. We have details on those rates. They vary by industry. The commercial activity tax in Ohio is 0.26%.
Based on
is quarter of a percent.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please. Yeah.
Yeah. This is just the income tax. There must be another chart. Is there another chart that you handed us that I should be looking for?
Representatives, we did have a chart that looked at those gross receipts based rates, and they were actually from the Ernst & Young study that I've kind of given you. I probably infringed copyrights, but I've given you a number of pages off of that. And one of them was a chart that showed the different states, showed Washington, Ohio, Texas, which has its gross margin tax, and looked at those. So I'd be happy to get that. I don't believe that's it. It's a smaller chart. So I'll make sure the committee has that for tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm doing some quick calculations. Were there other questions? Comment. I've been doing some quick calculations to see where these numbers fall, and it looks like in the top categories, at least, at the bottom end of the category, the rate reducing it to a rate would be about 0.1%.
Yeah.
And so of course, higher in the category, it's less than 0.1%.
Right, that's how all the categories that work that way. You get the highest rates as soon as you enter it into that category, and then it gradually falls. So it has that stair-step function.
Right. Other questions for Paul, so we can understand what this dash 9 does? We're not up to the Betsy yet, but we seem to be progressing right along. All right. Thank you. We appreciate it. And I think with that, unless there's something else, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3405. And colleagues, we plan to take this bill, 2649, 2180, and whatever else we have on the agenda for tomorrow up at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Any? What is 2531? Oh, is that ready? Do we have the paperwork on 2531? Oh, okay. All right. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2531. Who's on that? Chris, please, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you'll recall, House Bill 2531 is the so-called soccer bill. It would sequester some of the money to help pay for a soccer fund, soccer stadium. The new information that you have is a dash A5, which addresses three issues that were brought to light when the committee heard the bill last. And those three issues are the definition of employee, not the definition of employee, but in page 2, lines 4 and 5 of the drafted bill, there was a definition of a member of a professional soccer team, and the language referred to individuals rendering service, and depending on how that was interpreted, it could be much broader than employee. So that that wording has been moved or changed to employee to make very clear that these sequestered funds would be just from employees of the soccer teams, not anybody who renders service to the soccer team. The two other changes are the $15 million that is listed in the bill is changed to $5 million. You heard testimony last time that the expected revenue from this was $5 million over the life, over the 15 to 30 year lifespan of the bonds. And then the third change was actually a modification of the dash A4. And on page 4 of the bill, line 22, it puts essentially a deadline on when the City of Portland can make a written request to enter into these grant agreements. So if they don't enter into a grant agreement by July 1st, 2010, it's a kind of sunset. Mm-hmm. And the expectation there was that the city would know by then if they have all of the funding lined up for the project.
Is it going to do it or it's not?
Exactly.
All right.
And you had a revenue impact from last time, and then you also have a fiscal statement in your packet for the impact. So you have all of the necessary paperwork.
Ah. Colleagues, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Reed.
Move the adoption of the dash A5 amendments.
Representative Reed moves the A5. Any discussion? Is there any objection to the A5? Don't see any. Motion carries. A5s are adopted part of the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Reed.
Move House Bill 2531 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Reed moves House Bill 2531 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Call.
Yeah, I'd just like to put the let it be known that I'll be a no vote on this today. Just briefly, I do think that this is almost unprecedented besides Major League Baseball that we sequester funds. There was testimony that said that we had done something like this for TriMet and Transit. While that is true, that there was a legislative enactment here, it was overturned by the will of the voters in 1996 when Measure 32 went down. So this really is kind of unprecedented or very little precedented ground. It makes me very uncomfortable to sequester away general funds in this way. And then lastly, practically every day there is something in the newspaper about Lentz and Major League Soccer and baseball, that has turned into a nightmare for the City of Portland, and I would rather not partake of their nightmare, so I'll be a no today.
Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Gelser.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to state that I'll also be a no on this bill. I have significant discomfort with the precedent that it sets.
Thank you. I don't normally speak the way I'm about to on a bill that I opened a work session on, but I'm going to on this bill. I have a strong objection to this bill. I think that it is very imprudent of us to add an additional example to the ones we've already got, which are few at this point, for the idea of sequestering income tax funds for purposes other than regular state expenditures. This committee has spent a great deal of time trying to claw our way back from the process of essentially budgeting funds for purposes that the Ways and Means Committee never has a say in, and without any comparison between between the needs of the state budget on the one hand and the things that the Revenue Committee is asked to do on the other. We've spent a lot of time in this session and in prior sessions, in the prior session in 07 and I think even in 08, trying to claw back some of the tax credits and other exemptions, credits, and deductions that prior revenue committees and legislatures had adopted as an end run around the budget process. One of the things that we did with the baseball was a baseball bill, which was passed several sessions ago, and which I unfortunately, as a member, I think, of the Rules Committee at that time, supported. I regret having supported that bill because I think it was a mistake. What that bill did, and that bill's still on the books, what that bill did is it sequestered funds from the salaries of baseball players, which of course are considerably higher than the salaries for most soccer players, and to allow for a substantially larger amount to be funded through a private process to to pay off bonds. In one sense, it's a similar process to this one. There are some details that are different. The most important way in which they're similar, and which I now think was a serious error, both on the part of the legislature and for myself in my own vote, was that it appeared to me as though we were establishing yet another device to get around the Ways and Means process of allocating funds for state for public services. This TIF process, tax increment financing process, has a storied life, of course, and starting to add it to the process that we use in allocating what otherwise would be general fund revenues is, I think, very dangerous, one to be avoided. And this bill allocates a very small number of dollars. I think the number is $5 million now. Now, that's the amendment we adopted, up to $5 million in the A5s. Very small number of dollars. I would be astounded, frankly, if the process of bringing Major League Soccer to Portland, working on a stadium to make it suitable for the use of the Major League Soccer team, would be held up for the lack of the state's $5 million. That seems very, very unlikely to me. And if the program is teetering on that small a sum, it probably should not be done at all. So my only excuse for voting for the baseball bill is that it was a larger amount. This one has the disadvantage that the state's contribution is likely not to make the difference. It's very small. And it adds one more item to the process that we've been trying to undo, by which we, another scheme, another method, by which this committee can sidestep the ways and means process for allocating of general funds. I object to it. I think it's a wrong approach. I believe that it's a step backwards. I think the committee is on the right track on the things that we're doing in dealing with tax credits and in dealing with other aspects in which we essentially give away funds that are under the rate but are not spent on general funds because we've already dealt with them in some other way. So I will be a no on this bill. I will not support the bill here. I will not support it on the floor. I expect to speak against it on the floor, probably on the same basis. I think it's a step in the wrong direction, I don't believe that this. I think this committee and the legislature will live to regret putting yet another example of a bad theory to use as a result of this bill, in addition to the two or three that we already have. Other discussion, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very brief comment to thank you, the Chair, for opening this work session on a bill that you have strong feelings about and for allowing those of us that respectfully see the situation a little bit differently to vote on this bill. And you have my gratitude for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the majority of the conversation that's just taken place, of the majority of the people that have spoken, I'm wondering if I should check my party affiliation. that said, I will be voting no on this bill for many of the reasons that have been cited, but most primarily, I can see myself sitting at the table at the coffee klatch in the Covered Bridge Coffee House or the corner kitchen in Lebanon, and the guy's sitting around the table and saying, you took our general fund dollars, money that could have been in our general fund, and you spent it on what? And I think their language would be much more colorful than mine has been. And everybody knows that right now. So that said, that's not how I can choose to allocate their dollars. I'll be voting no on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Springer. Other comments? Please call the roll. The motion is on sending the bill to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Bentz.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Bruhn.
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
No.
Representative Call?
No.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
No.
No. The motion having received the required majority is adopted, and the bill will go to the floor with a due pass. It's awkward for me to assign a carrier on the bill. For those of you who voted yes, want to agree among yourselves who's going to carry this bill?
You don't want to carry it, Mr. Speaker?
I'm not going to carry it. No, I'm going to speak against it.
I wouldn't object.
Here. I'm happy to carry the bill, Mr. Chair.
Is that the plan? Okay, Representative.
Representative Reed, but I'm happy to do it.
Representative Bailey will carry, and with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2531. And is there any other business for today? Paul, have I done what I need to do?
9 a.m. tomorrow, not
8.
Not 8.
Ooh.
Not 8.
9. Why 9?
That's what we're posted for.
We're posted for 9 o'clock. The floor will start at 9:45, so we have our work cut out for us. I understand that the initial part of the session will probably not involve controversial matters, so we may be able to run a little bit past that. But we have a lot of work to do, so be here promptly at 9, ready to work. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Interesting.